Good morning, members.
I'm not tardy for my class today.
Good morning.
Representative Hornstein, it's nice to see you. Speaking of Representative Hornstein, we have the minutes in front of us for February 14th. Would you care
to move the minutes?
Thank you. Any additions or corrections on the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Just don't want to post the minutes. Today, we'll pick up where we left off yesterday. And we have Fish and Wildlife members. We asked you yesterday to save your little infograms that you have. If you'd open up to Fish and Wildlife, we have Jim Leach is here today along with Barb Ulick. And we'll continue. Before we do that, I have one little thing to talk about. I got a text message from a constituent yesterday who lives in Roseau. And of course, you know that in Roseau and in my district, at Roseau, we make Polaris snowmobiles. And then also Arcticat snowmobiles in the district. And there were a couple of DNR vehicles running around the Roseau area yesterday with Ski-Doo snowmobiles in the back of them. So it doesn't go over all that well, just an FYI. So thank you. So, and with that, we will proceed. Representative Sundin, did I miss something?
Okay. Oh, I was just curious about that. I kind of smell a bill.
Keep sniffing. So, with that, Ms. Julek, you had a correction on some of your testimony from yesterday, if you would proceed with that, and then Director Leach, if you would continue from there. So, and specifically, can you tell me whose question you may be addressing? So, thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, yesterday Representative Heisman had a question relating to Parks and Trails structural issues within their budget and asked how long, if the governor's budget was passed, how long this would take us. My answer was 2 years, but I wanted to make sure that people understood that was referring to the expenditure side or the appropriation side. And then we talked about how inflation comes into play, and we need to analyze that every 2 years, how it's impacting our base budget, and then whether to make a request or not. So I just want to clarify that 2 years was a expenditure side answer, not a revenue side answer, and just to be clear about that.
Thank you for that. And I know, Ms. Julek, that you work hard at what you do, and you're very concerned about accuracy, and I and the rest of the committee appreciate it a great deal and the work that you do. Thank you. Director Leach, here you are.
Good morning.
If you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Jim Leach. I'm the director for Fish and Wildlife. I'm here today to talk with you about our proposal for a fee increase within the Game and Fish Fund. The Game and Fish Fund, as you're well aware, is the primary source of funding for my division. The revenues coming from that pay for the foundation of the division, which is really the biological assessments and field work that our field staff do, gathering information, population information, on the harvestable species in the state, from pheasants to deer to walleyes, sturgeon. All the base assessment work is done out of the Game and Fish Fund, which is funded, obviously, through hunter and angler licenses. That fund is going down, and as we have, and this body has in the past, funded increases on the average of every 5 or 6 years. So it's a pattern that we really haven't solved, but consistently comes up periodically, 5 or 6 years, as I've said. The angling and fishing and angling and hunting community have really grown to expect certain services from DNR, and those are the services that we try to provide. And with the funding in decline, we've had to cut back, obviously, on some of the things, and I will get into those as we get through this presentation. Currently in Minnesota, we have about 600,000 hunters and trappers and about 1.5 million anglers in the state. Jointly, they have an expenditure that's pretty impressive, $3.9 billion that they spend to chase their recreational pursuits, be it fur or feather or fin. That expenditure of resources generates about 48,000 private sector jobs within the industry surrounding hunting and fishing. And as many of you well know, that supports many of our out-state local communities. And I think the priority of tourism and hunting and fishing is a priority in out-state Minnesota. As I mentioned, the fund is in decline, and we realize this, and we've done things to cut back. We've made significant efficiencies in some areas. We're holding currently 43 positions that we have not filled and probably will not fill until we know what the status of our future budget is. And as you heard yesterday with other presentations, and I'm sure you're well aware of this, the buying power of our dollar has gone down. Things that we were purchasing 5-6 years ago, market increases from nets to boats to equipment that we use for assessment work. There's some other things that have really challenged the Game and Fish Fund as well. I'll talk a little bit about the Office of the Legislator Auditor's report last year on our deer management program. That body evaluated DNR to see how we were doing with deer management and came back to us with a number of recommendations. One of those recommendations was to write the first ever statewide deer management plan. And to do that, we formed an advisory committee made up of private citizens from across the state and a broad and diverse group of individuals representing agencies and nonprofit organizations, from deer hunters associations to Department of Ag. We have private citizens from the cattlemen's industry, just a whole host of folks on that committee to again inform us as to what they'd like to see in this deer management plan. In addition to that, we're holding 12 public meetings around the state, many of which have occurred already, maybe in your districts or in your areas of responsibility. And again, there we're looking for the public to come and tell us what they want to see with respect to this deer management plan. So it's a major endeavor, writing a plan going from north to south, east to west. So we're tackling that, and we will have that completed by the spring of 2018. That's diverting significant DNR resources, staff power primarily, into an area that we weren't expecting. And other things are, as you would expect, sliding or put on hold until we're done with this deer management plan.
Director Meech, I have a question with regards to that. You mentioned in the group, the working group that's looking into the deer management plan, you mentioned cattlemen's from around the state. I was told by one of my constituents that they had been told that they were going to be appointed to the working group by DNR, and then when it came out, that individual was not appointed to the deer study group. I'd like specifically to know, and you don't have to answer it now, but I want to know specifically who represents the Minnesota Cattlemen's Association on that working group.
Mr. Chair, members, I know of the individual that you're speaking of. When we went to the Minnesota Cattlemen's Association, we asked specifically if they would nominate some individuals or reach out to some of their members and provide us those individuals who they were, and they did do that. And the individual that we did select, let me back up a little bit. We asked them to reach out to their members. A number of their members made application for the Deer Advisory Committee. What we did with those names is take the name and the address off of all applicants. There were about 300 applicants for 20 positions. So we took the name and the address off of all applications, and we had an internal team of DNR staff review the application for its merits and eliminate those individuals with poorer responses than some of the better responses on some of the questions that we asked. Once they got that down to about 50 individuals, then they put the name and the address back on it so we knew who the individual was, so we could get broad representation from across the state. The individual that you speak of made the final selection, but so did two other of their counterparts. And when we looked at the physical distribution of where those individuals were, we selected another cattleman from, I think it's the Mespaw area of southwest of the Twin Cities, and that's the individual who represents the Cattlemen's Association.
Thank you.
The second challenge that I'd like to bring up to the chair and the committee here is disease management. You may remember from a couple years ago, DNR and the Department of Ag was working on avian influenza and its persistence in turkey barns and chicken barns around the state. That presented a significant challenge, again, of diverting DNR staff working on our priorities to another disease outbreak that we dealt with. Currently, we're working on chronic wasting disease in a number of fronts, primarily in southeastern Minnesota, dealing with that disease in our deer herd and our wild deer herd, and then recently finding out that it's been documented in two cervid farms in Minnesota as well, which will require DNR to do surveillance around those farms this next hunting season. And the last thing that I'll mention, aging equipment. Our fisheries division has not replaced boats and motors and nets that they do for some of their survey work in a number of years. And within our budget request is dollars for that specific function. It would be a one-time function, a one-time ask for dollars to purchase new equipment for our fishery staff. You've seen this chart before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where were those boats and motors going to be made?
Director Leach. Not in Roseau,
I bet. I am going to have to apologize. I did not hear the question.
That's right, Director. I was just wondering where those boats and motors were going to be made. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair and members, I think we're going to put out a bid, as I think the state typically does, and go with the low bid. So I really can't say who it's going to come from at this present time.
Thank you. Proceed with your testimony.
This chart that we have up is something that Ms. Julik has created for all the divisions. It illustrates the dollars to restore, maintain, and invest in my division. And again, I will call your attention to the invest category, the topic that I just talked about an investment in new equipment for our fisheries division, plus some deer research. Given the outbreak of CWD in the southeast, we want to do some research on CWD to document how it spreads. We've never had it in a part of the state that has the topography like the southeast, with all the river systems and streams. And we think that the deer are obviously spreading it themselves, but how it's transmitted out of these geographic areas is really of interest to us, so we'd like to do a study to document exactly how that happens.
The Pennsylvania has a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that we're looking at studying CWD and some of those difficulties. How much money are we talking about? I'm not seeing it here in the presentation.
In the previous table, the invest category, it's identified as about $1.5 million. With the fisheries work, or the fisheries equipment that would be purchased, plus the deer research is combined into that total. About 1.1 for equipment, and the rest would be for research for deer.
Representative
Hansen.
Excuse me, Representative Hansen, follow up?
Yes. So just to be clear, do we have a breakdown of what would go towards the CWD issue, or is it?
Mr. Chair, members, not with me, but if you would like that, I sure can get you that breakdown of this number for CWD versus what would be used for fisheries equipment.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Director, I guess I'm not necessarily super concerned about the exact number. I just wanted to kind of check. I know that there's a number of states, Wisconsin, for example, that spent many millions of dollars doing work on this issue, and I just wouldn't want that research to be repetitive. And it sounds like this is something in a sort of a smaller context, maybe something more specific that hasn't been looked at, which in that case would be fantastic.
Mr. Chair, members, the request here is for a specific research project. If you're talking about overall expenditures for disease monitoring and specifically CWD monitoring, there's a Servant Health account which 50 cents off of every purchase of a deer license goes to, and that account we use for disease monitoring and surveillance. And that fund right now is in the decline, as you would expect, with the outbreak in southeast Minnesota. And we're anticipating that that fund will be zeroed out early next year. And there is going to be a supplemental request coming forward that you haven't seen yet for CWD surveillance and monitoring.
Representative Heinzman, you're good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, because I know that we oftentimes look other places in the country to kind of see, well, where are we having success and maybe where are we finding that maybe not so much success. Do we know currently where Wisconsin is at in terms of their CWD issue? What are they spending now, and maybe what are they, any plans? Because obviously their issue is similar, but at a much different scale.
Dr. Leach.
Mr. Chair and members, the point of time where Wisconsin is their critical area in southwestern Wisconsin, they're looking to just contain it. There's no effort in Wisconsin to eradicate CWD in their hot zones, and that's that area southwest of Madison in the southwest part of the state. What they are trying to do is stop the spread of CWD in Wisconsin, and they're addressing those breakout areas very similar to how Minnesota is doing, where we go in and try to eradicate the disease once we detect it.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Director, just here, because we're trying to learn as much as we can about this, and it's just something that you and I have talked offline a little bit about because it's affecting my district specifically as well. I've been, trying to do my own research, but I'm wondering, have you found or seen examples anywhere in the country where they have been successful at, like you had mentioned, eradicating CWD? Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, there has been no successful eradication effort thus far. Illinois and Minnesota are probably leading the way in where the disease is as far as containment, but it's like any disease. If we sit back and wait like Wisconsin does, it's going to be here forever. And what we're trying to do is be proactive and aggressive where it shows up. So the deer herd in Minnesota is valuable not only from an economic standpoint, but from a social aspect too. And to identify a disease and then do nothing is not an alternative for us. And our position is we're going to attack it as aggressively as we can, trying to eradicate it. It has never been successful, but we look at Pine Island and what we did at Pine Island the first time CWD was identified in Minnesota. It has not showed back up at Pine Island. So I think we've been very successful where we identify it quickly and early and then aggressively address it.
Sometimes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Director, I guess what I'm driving at is and sometimes this comes up in other conversations, the definition of insanity, trying to, do the same thing over and over again and getting the same results. Are we doing anything different than other states? And as you had mentioned, we've never, that we are aware of, been able to eradicate CWD. And I'm not I'm not supporting a notion that we wouldn't do anything. I'm just trying to figure out, what are we going to do different? Do we have any ideas or plans or processes that we would consider doing that might be different than what other states have done and failed at doing, or actually being successful in the process of trying to eradicate CWD and not being successful? Do we have any other plans in place?
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, our plan right now is to address it as we have. We have a disease response plan that has been written 6-8 years ago, and we're following that plan. Really, what other states, Iowa, North and South Dakota, all the states that border us have CWD and are really following what we're doing and following our lead. I think Illinois and Minnesota are probably the most successful in containing it. I will even use eradicating. I mean, we were successful at Pine Island at keeping it out of there. We don't know how the disease found its way to Preston, Minnesota, in the southeast. There's a lot of speculation on how it got there, but there's no definitive identification of the source of how that disease spread to the southeast.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I think we are doing things different than Wisconsin. Wisconsin just said, heck with it, we'll let it get established. And this is the debate we've had over the last 10 years with a variety of invasive species. This is just another invasive species. And so whether it was emerald ash borer or zebra mussels, we'll have the biologists say we need to do something, and then we'll have commerce react. Now, I don't mean the Department of Commerce. I mean businesses react and say, well, we can't do that because that'll disrupt our business. And so we go back and forth, and then we'll have the exact same discussion. It's just inevitable. Let's just let it happen. And then it will happen if that's this. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I'm concerned, you know, the 50 cents that's paid is paid by hunters. If the game and fish fee increase is going to go to pay for dealing with mitigation, whether it's analysis or dealing with it, we're ignoring the reality that we have a very risky business of penned deer farming. And that's where we're seeing contamination occur with this invasive species. And they're not paying anything. So the public, the hunters are having to pay, or the general fund will have to pay, but the risky business won't pay for the public consequence of that. And it's just, here we go again. I guess that's where we might agree, is here we go again on this. The same thing happens over and over, where people say we need to do something, and then it comes down to who pays. I don't think it's right for the hunters to pay for this, to protect the public herd. Maybe the general fund, but if there's such high profit with high risk, then those penned deer farms should pick up some of the cost that's involved.
Representative Green.
My question was, I get a lot of emails on the deer feeding, and you brought up the fact that you got the 50 cents charge on licenses for chronic waste. Is that the same 50 cents that was supposed to go for feeding, or is there a separate account?
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, the Servant Health account is account that we can use for disease control or during severe winters for feeding as well. The feeding ban that I think you're referring to, we put into effect once CWD is documented in the geographic area to assist us in limiting the spread of the disease.
Mr. Chair, then just one more question. I had asked this the last time I think you were here. In reference to manganese and also low copper in the diet of the deer, and because that was a study that came, I believe, out of Europe that I read, when they, because they have the disease there as well, and they have for many years. And I'm wondering if, you, if you've looked into that, if that could be a cause of this.
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know the study that you're referring to, but I would assume that our CWD biologist that's responsible knows of the study and has evaluated it. I can say I personally have not, but I'm sure our CWD expert, Dr. Cornicelli, is well aware of it and has evaluated for its merits.
Just for me, then, if you could find that out and either have them contact me or give me information just to see if they have looked into it, because like Representative Heinzman was saying, you know, we don't want to try to reinvent the wheel, and we do, or not, shouldn't say reinvent the wheel. We don't want to go back and rehash something that's already been done, whether it worked or not. If it didn't work, we can eliminate it, and if it is the cause, let's pinpoint it based on research that's already been done instead of starting all over.
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, one more comment on CWD before we leave, and deer in general. The Deer Advisory Committee, and during some of these public meetings that we're holding around the state, we are hearing similar concerns to what Representative Hansen brought up about the deer hunter paying for the surveillance on service farms. So that will be something, and it is something that we've heard about from the general public and the deer hunting community.
Proceed.
The slide that we have in front of you now is really looking at the proposal for the fee increase, generating about $4.4 million to restore shelved abilities to do survey and assessment, that foundational work for hunting, for setting season length and bag limits, $1.1 million for that ask, that would be a one-time asked for dollars for equipment for our fisheries division and some hatchery work, and then $19.9 million that would go into the game and fish account to maintain that solvency of the account into the future. Some of the things that I really want to stress that I think we can tell you that we would get with these dollars would be the continued stocking of Minnesota's fish, the walleye. We've had to cut back on some of our stocking because of dollars available. We've done an analysis of walleye stocking on about 300 lakes in Minnesota, and we're almost finished with that evaluation to see what is the most effective way to stock walleyes in a lake. Can we put unlimited of walleyes in a lake and increase that population? That's what we're trying to find out, and we're very close to having that evaluation of all the lakes completed, so we know what's the most efficient way to stock walleyes in a lake. These dollars are also proof for significant habitat improvements on our 1,400 wildlife management areas across the state, allowing the Minnesota public to have free access to quality hunting opportunities. We've curtailed a lot of our habitat work on WMAs because of our shortfalls. And then lastly, I think we'll talk a little bit about, too, the, you know, with CWD and some of the other diseases, these dollars will allow us to perpetuate the hunting tradition and deer camp in Minnesota for the next generation with a healthy deer herd.
Representative Eklund has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director. The walleye stocking issue triggered a question that I've had from my resort community constituents. They want to know why the DNR is stocking walleyes in lakes that will not have a natural reproduction, and wondering what the sense in doing that is.
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, there are lakes that DNR does stock that will not have natural reproduction, and that's what the evaluation that I referred to is looking at. we're evaluating the effectiveness of it. If it's a put-and-take sort of situation, we get lobbied at times from the general public to do things that you talk about, to put walleyes in lakes that will have no reproductive capability going into the future. And our evaluation of the effectiveness of that is to document just that. If, in fact, it's not cost-effective to do those things, we're planning to eliminate it. So those are the types of things that we would look at and not move forward on and continuing that behavior in the future.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate hearing that, because I would think that if we're going to stock lakes with a species, it would be more conducive to stock them with something that's native to that situation.
Thank you. And Director Leach, I mean, I don't know how long this has been going on. It's been going on since I've been here, and it would seem to me that there should be some lakes that have been scratched off your list already for walleye stocking. I mean, I love to fish walleyes, don't get me wrong. Lake of the Woods is a great place for me to spend a few days in the summertime and winter. But I think we need to focus our attention a little bit more. And I will go back to the comments you made about the WMA and the enhancement and so forth. I'm going to repeat my call to DNR to be more public and more vocal, more outspoken in recruiting and trying to get people involved in those projects through the Adopted WMA program or through cooperative farm agreement programs. Quite frankly, I'm extremely frustrated with the inability and the unwillingness of DNR to access that program that the legislature put in place. Representative Wagenius.
Just to follow up on the walleye stocking issue, do you have knowledge of the unintended consequences of stocking a fish in a lake that doesn't reproduce it? What are the consequences on the other fish that are naturally reproducing or are naturally native to that lake?
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, there are unintended consequences. Walleyes represent and occupy a niche within a lake system that is a little bit different than most of your other shallow lake fishes, like northerns, bass, panfish. So there's going to be a varying impact, on these other species. That's, again, the type of thing that we're looking at, and perpetuating a put-and-take situation is really not what we're looking for, and the evaluation and its effect on these other species was part of our evaluation. So we'll be able to document that once we get this evaluation done, which will be this year.
Thank you. So that was not evaluated before you did the put-and-take?
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, we had an idea of what it was going to do. There are certain shallow lakes that we put walleyes in that there's really not a large fisheries population. We're putting them in there as brood rearing areas, and then we take them out in the fall and then restock them into other lakes. So there's a whole host of shallow lakes where walleyes are put into for various purposes, some for fishing for that community, some for brood rearing that we would take out in the fall and transplant to other lakes for stocking purposes.
Representative Buckingham.
Well, I think it's not getting at my question. My basic question is, did you understand the biology of the rest of the fish population before you did the put and take of walleyes that didn't naturally reproduce?
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we do understand that. The effects are not as great as what one would think, because walleyes occupy a different niche within that system. Bass are pretty prolific, northerns, panfish, very prolific individuals. Walleyes will predominantly focus on minnows and perch in lakes. The carrying capacity in the lake is really not substantially altered by stocking walleyes because of that occupying a niche that those other species don't have or don't frequent.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
you're welcome.
I think I just don't understand what does not substantially alter means, because that's a...
It's subjective.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate you coming before us, Director. My kind of question, this is coming from southwest Minnesota, where we have kind of a lot of shallow pothole-type lakes. And, you know, the question came up from Representative Eklund about the put and take and, you know, the validity. You know, I'm thinking some of our lakes may not be as productive, but so are our resource. Are you looking regionally on, you know, because walleye fishing is important across the state? You know, there may be some counties that only have shallow lakes that may countywide not have a reproductive walleye lake. Are those ideas as far as you, the stopping of the stocking of some of those lakes, that take that into account, you know, as far as kind of regionally what's available for walleye fishing?
Mr. Chair, members, the evaluation of walleye stocking program is done statewide, so we have lakes that we're evaluating from across the state. What we're looking for is really looking at the biology and the efficiency of the program. The political decision of if we stock a shallow lake that we know will not provide reproductive success in the future, that's more of a political decision that we will take into account. But right now we're really looking at the evaluation of the biology.
Thank you. Members, I really want to get through this part, so let's keep your questions until the end.
Okay.
And I'm not picking on anybody. Okay, I did the same thing myself, so. I got detention for it, too. So.
The graph we have in front of you now is just an illustration of where the Game and Fish Fund is. 2017, below $10 million. 2018, moving below $5 million, and then 2019, would be insolvent in 2019 unless the fee increase is enacted this year. And then the last slide that I have you is just to bring to your attention an item that's within the governor's budget that affects the game and fish account. Currently, we have about 6,800 individuals, disabled vets, that are 100% disabled and are given free hunting and fishing licenses. The proposal before, within the governor's budget, the proposal is to reduce that to 50% disability for Minnesota veterans, and that would increase the number of vets that would qualify for free hunting and fishing licenses to 22,800. And the governor is proposing to offset that loss of revenue to the game and fish account with a general fund ask. So, again, just wanted to bring that to your attention. Mr. Chair, that concludes my remarks, and I will take questions at this time.
Thank you. Ms. Julek.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I just want to clarify that even though this is a Department of Veterans Affairs proposal, it is in our budget and in front of your committee, and so it's being carried within our budget, and as you look at the appropriation bill of the governor's budget, the language is in the DNR section.
And Ms. Julek, if I missed it, I apologize, but the 50 cents that comes out of the deer license and so forth, what does that generate for income per biennium? If you could find that,
yep.
You know.
Okay.
I know that. Representative Sundin, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of asks in here for fee increases, that type of thing. I'm just wondering, because Representative Howell is not here, I'm going to ask a question for him. What's the return on our investment here? What I need to know is how much money does the deer hunting industry raise in tax revenues for the state of Minnesota, the fishing revenues, tax revenues, that type of thing. So I view these as investments, and I'm just wondering what the state of Minnesota gets in return.
Ms. Julie.
Mr. Chair, we'll have to follow up on that.
Yeah.
I know we have that number.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I'm not even sure if this is the place to ask this question, but
I'll let you know.
There's some online education, boater safety, hunting safety, and stuff like that. that the DNR has for people to get certified. Does the DNR get a fee from the vendor that they contract with on those services?
To testifiers, either one.
Mr. Chair, members, you're seeing a blank look. I don't have an answer on that one, and I don't want to say something that I'm not confident about, so we would have to follow up on that. I'm not sure what the vendors get with educational materials that are put on the web. If it was for a license sale, I could respond, but for educational information, I really don't know. We'll have to get back with you on that.
Representative Eklund.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up on that is I appreciate you getting back, and then if you consider open sourcing to other vendors if there's competition out there.
Ms. Julik.
Mr. Chair, to your question about the 50 cents for the certified deer, the forecast is for the 18-19 biennium is around, it ranges from $336,000 to
$360,000
per year.
Okay, thank you. Director Leach.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Leach, would it be possible when you're using the fees, let's say it's for a fisheries upgrade or like a fish hatchery, would it be possible to put like a small plaque that says, you know, these upgrades are paid for by the hunting and fishing fees of the people of Minnesota? Or I mean, I think there has to be some way of showing outcomes for the public in terms of what do you get, and that's where the skepticism comes in from people of where does the money go. And I, you know, for monitoring that, you can put that in the report, but when you are doing things, you know, or when you're doing purchases or improvements, I think it's valuable. We were supposed to be doing that with Legacy to show what happens there. But I think, particularly on hunting and fishing fees, a $30 plaque saying, you know, this is paid for by the people of Minnesota through their hunting and fishing licenses, I think is a small price that helps you in the long run to show what the money is being used for.
Director Leach.
Mr. Chair, members, I would agree that the challenge is at times, on a capital investment, I think it's a little bit easier to do what you're asking, and I think that is a very good suggestion. On things like, well, we could even do it on boats and motors and things like that, but when you get into some of the assessment equipment, netting or binoculars, things like that are smaller scale and not capital investments, there is somewhat of a challenge. A lot of the game and fish dollars go to habitat improvements. We could have signage at WMAs that some of the habitat improvements could be done or would be done with game and fish dollars. But legacy dollars, as this committee well knows, pays for those improvements periodically as well, as does private dollars coming from private NGOs like Pheasants Forever or the Deer Hunters. So it's a range of things. I think your idea is sound. It's just a matter of where we could do it on some capital investment item.
Thank you, Director Leach. Next up we have Director Skinner. Representative Cornish has a question.
Well, real quickly, while they're coming up, we're getting ready, when we go back to the fisheries, it's really a great program. Actually, they got putting sack fry in these shallow lakes and raising up the fingerling. Some lake stocks, or stocking some lakes, they don't respond well to sack fry, so they like to grow them up to be fingerlings. And in our area where they've done that, they only get a small percentage of the walleye fingerlings out, and then the fishermen come in and the ice houses and just pepper these lakes that normally don't get used and catch beautiful walleyes out of there. So it's working out well, both in the stocking and the fishing in our area. So,
thank you for that, Representative Cornish. Mr. Skinner, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Luke Skinner, Director of the Division of Ecological and Water Resources for the DNR. Mr. Chair and committee members, the Division of Ecological and Water Resources is pretty broad in the work that it does. Its primary goal is to promote and deliver integrated conservation of water resources biological diversity, you know, for healthy watershed. As we talk about these broad areas we have three kind of core areas that we work. We have a regulatory function around water permitting, water appropriate water works, and, work in public waters, dam safety permitting, and invasive species work. We manage some lands, including scientific and natural areas from across the state. We also work with native prairie bank easements and others. And we also provide lots of technical guidance, whether it's on water, rare species, and a lot of project work that folks do across the state, local units of government, and landowners on projects. So this technical guidance piece is quite large, along with all the resources. We are responsible for a lot of the data that comes out on whether it's climate, water, rare and endangered species are all provided by our division to the public for when they're making decisions, resource decisions on projects in the field. So this critical information is key for what we do across the state. Mr. Chair, as you've heard from other divisions, we have some of the same challenges across the state. The erosion of funding and increased costs have reduced our ability to protect and provide sustainable use of Minnesota's natural resources through these. And a couple of examples I wanted to provide. When it comes to non-game work and that we do across the state, most of that work is funded through through donations, and then it was matched with state wildlife grants. And as you can see over time, even with our concerted efforts to promote this program, it continues to decline in the amount of dollars that we receive incoming, especially through the income tax checkoff. You can have the Chickadee checkoff, but we also receive other donations. So we've been trying to manage there and the work that we do based on some of those changes. In addition, you can also see on the invasive species program that we have a structural deficit which will go negative in FY19. The appropriations exceed revenues that are coming in, and we have cut back some of our work currently, and we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go down, that helps us manage our programs long term. Also, some of our programs such as the Minnesota Biological Survey and SNA programs have been primarily funded with one-time fundings or from LCCMR and others, which has been really nice. We're looking for how do we manage long-term for these programs at its base.
Director Skinner, can you go back to that slide again, the AIS funding shortfalls? You know, we've appropriated a significant amount of money to that. Can we get more detail on where you think the shortfall is coming from? Are you referring to the money that was in the tax bill that got vetoed last year? What? I need some clarity.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, I have a slide on that coming up. Okay. Can we let you wait till I get to that point?
Thank you.
Okay. So, committee members, here's a list of proposals coming through the governor's recommendations that we will touch on through all these, and we'll get to the next slide. And it really focuses on those three areas. Restore, maintain, and invest. And we're trying to restore and some of the work that we're doing in public waters protection, our AIS program, which we'll talk about coming up. Of course, the operating adjustments for all of our staff and work, but also some work to maintain some of that rare resources management around the SNA program and MBS, biological survey, and the Clean Water Fund, which is Clean Water Legacy, which is a much larger proposal. And we do want to look at some investment opportunities around AIS, Pineland Sand Study, and some Mississippi River Corridor, Critical Corridor Area Rule Implementation, which we'll talk about as well. Mr. Chair, committee, the first proposal is what we're terming as public waters protection. So permit fees come in to work on work protect reuse to protect lakes and wetlands and streams. Fees from public water works permits, and these are permit fees that come in. So when somebody wants to do a project in a public water, we have to permit that and make sure it's done in a sustainable way. Well, really short, that permitting program only brings in a small part of what this program brings in. Overall, in the water management account, there's about $5 million. Of that, only about $200,000 come in from public water works permits. And so for us to carry out this work, we use a little bit of water management account dollars, we have some general fund, and a little bit of heritage enhancement. So it's really supplemented heavily by some of the fees that come in for water appropriation fees. It's all for the same purpose, for what we call 103G, which is water management. But we really need to see how we can support this. And from that, it's eroded over time, and we are not able to provide some of those services. So what we would like asking to do is to increase the permit fees for work in public waters. Currently, they run from $100 to $1,000. A GP or a general permit is $100. A current individual permit fee starts at $150, and then the maximum is up to $1,000. And we're looking for fee increases to have the individual fee start at $300 with a maximum of $5,000 for the largest of those permits for there's a lot of work going on.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a general breakdown of how much of those fees are paid by local units of government, townships, cities, and county when they have to do work for bridges or a road that passes close to a lake? I'm just trying to get a general idea of how much local units of government are involved in those permit costs.
Director Skinner. Mr. Chairman, Representative, I have a breakdown of the total by each one, but we might be able to go back and look at that. I don't have that right here, but I have breakdowns overall, but not for the individuals, but we can certainly try to look at that.
Yeah, I definitely would like to see that, because we start pushing fees up, we need to understand that they clearly may impact local units of government, so it just reach into the other taxpayers' pocket, and so we want to be cautious about that.
So you're suggesting we raise property taxes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, three members, the next proposal.
Neuberger, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. Thank you, Mr. Skinner, for being here today. I just have a question here. I'm looking at the page 90 on our big ring binder here. You have the little factoids, little bullet points. It says here that second bullet point in the upper left-hand corner, at a glance, it says annually you have issued 1,200 water appropriation permit decisions and 900 permit decisions for activities affecting public waters. I just wanted to ask you about that first category, the 1,200 water appropriation permit decisions. How many of those were denials?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, I brought that with me. I can... I believe, Representative Neuberger, I'll find it. It was one or two in the last calendar year.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying there were two denials out of the 1,200 requests?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, for fiscal year 2016, sorry, wrong form. Let me see if I do have it here. If not, I can send it to you, but let me see if I do have that information.
We can get that later offline.
Okay.
Representative Neuberger, you're on record as asking the question, and we'll make sure that we get that information for
you. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Director Skinner. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is aquatic invasive species, which we referred to earlier. The breakdown right now for the budget for the DNR's invasive species program is a $5 surcharge on boat licenses, which brings in just under $3 million. Annually, we have a general fund appropriation of around $3 million, and the total budget is around $7 million for the DNR's budget. At one time, a biennium ago, there was $400,000 that was provided one time to work with local units of government, counties to implement their programs, which went away. But the main work here is through the erosion from this. The budget is driving down. So what we've tried to do, we have not been able to spend all the dollars that have been appropriated because the base fund of the invasive species count is going down. So to manage that, we've reduced grants to local units of government for prevention, grants for management. We've reduced our watercraft inspection work, and we would have to do some more of that same type of work into the future. So we're reducing efforts right now across the state to manage that current shortfall that's coming. So right now our proposal is to increase that fee from $5 to $12. Members, just to understand that this is a three-year This is a three-year permit or license, and so currently they're paying $1.33 a year, and that would jump up to $4 a year. The last time the increase occurred for the AIS surcharge was back in 1993.
Representative Eklund has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director, for coming. This aquatic invasive species issue is obviously huge in the state of Minnesota, and so you're proposing a fee increase on boat licenses, but at the same time, the DNR is proposing putting in multiple new boat accesses in lakes across the state, some of them that already have accesses. So if we're going to control aquatic invasive species, how are we going to do that by putting more accesses into multiple lakes in the state?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, statewide there are close to, I believe, 6,000 accesses across the state, but about 1,500 of those are public accesses. There's another 1,500, I would say, that are private. And so by adding an individual access on a lake is not going to prevent the spread itself, or to be able to manage is not going to help. What we need to do is have a comprehensive program where we have shared responsibility. Our current law is that it's illegal to transport aquatic invasive species, and that's where the main function is. We then supplemented that with dollars to do access inspections and awareness and decontamination at the highest use areas. Currently, there's also $10 million that now goes to the county so they can actually implement their own programs at a county level to help prevent the spread. Trying to control every access in the state would be extremely difficult. We did a big report, I would say, about 6 or 8 years ago that looked at what it would cost to do required control or required inspection at every access or do a centralized control program. It was estimated that it would cost between $20 and $50 million annually to try to do this kind of oversight. So right now, our best efforts are to be able to prevent spread is to have our laws, use the education, use our enforcement abilities and our inspection program statewide to educate and reduce the risk of spread.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that you made my point is by adding more accesses, especially to lakes that already have them, whether they're private or public, is just potentially going to make the problem larger.
Representative Buglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Director, two things. Could you expand a little bit on your outreach to local lake associations and what you're doing with them, and also the education effort for the public on AIS?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eagle, a good portion of our budget has been around public education and outreach. We've worked closely with lake associations across the state for decades on two ways. One, we've provided them grant funding so they can do their own public awareness activities. And we've also provided grant dollars so they can manage the invasive species that they have in their lakes. We also have staff in the field that provide technical guidance to lake associations, and they've done this for a number of years and work very, very closely with them. We also have a statewide campaign for public education through billboards, social media, a variety of different ways to get the word out. But lake associations have been a critical component for us to work with in working with those COLAs and lake associations across the state. They've also been a key part of our AIS statewide advisory group that comes and helps us provide guidance on what the next steps and provide guidance on where we should put our dollars into the future.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have an aquatics invasive research center at the U working on some of the aquatic invasives that we have. Are there opportunities that we are missing to figure out ways to stop invasives that are different than just cleaning off boats? I mean, can science help us out here in ways that we're missing?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, the Research Center, MESARC, at the University of Minnesota is really critical for our long-term management of invasive species. We can prevent the spread as much as we can or slow the spread, but if we don't develop tools to help reduce the impact they have once they get here, then they're missing out. And so whether it's on purple loosestrife or Eurasian water milfoil or zebra mussels or starry stone right now, it's really key that we do this research to figure out how can we manage them better to reduce the impacts once they do get established. And part of this part of this dollars would look for up to $500,000 would go towards research, with the bulk of that potentially going to the university for research, just as you're suggesting.
I think it would be helpful for us to understand exactly where research could help us and what we are funding. Because I don't know how much, say, for zebra mussels. I don't know if research could help us more or not, but we should know because management is really expensive.
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gaines, I agree, and we don't do this in a vacuum either. This research, we work with other states and federal agencies on this, so we try to pool our resources so we can be as effective as possible, and we can certainly share with you some of our priorities. We can pull that together, and what we've also pulled together what the university's priorities are right now and share those as well.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Skinner, do you know how much money was in the Clean Water Fund through Legacy this year?
Director Skinner.
I can help him out.
I know you can.
It was in excess of $228 million for the biennium. Can you tell me how much of that is spent on AIS?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I believe very little, if any, is spent on invasive species.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Skinner, I agree. And I think we need to change that. When Legacy was passed, and I won't go into a big detail, but one of the reasons it was passed, it was proposed as the Clean Water Legacy. And so one of the reasons it was even voted for was that we would use it for keeping our waters clean. And very little of the clean water portion of that is going for what I would consider to be anything substantial. And I think last year some of the money that we even appropriated to the DNR was cut, I think it was $400,000, and put into another fund that should have been gone into AIS, and I'll look that up to be sure. But, before we start looking at putting more money into AIS here, I think we should start looking into the dedicated funds that we have for it. Maybe we should be looking in that area instead.
Director Skinner, comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, the Clean Water Legacy, as you know, is a big process. The department has a proposal right now through the governor's recommendation. And I'll be talking a little bit about what's in there right now, and it does not include invasive species management or research at this point.
Proceed. I think, Director Skinner, I think there's a substantial appetite that maybe we should take a look at doing that. That will be another conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next proposal, Mr. Chair, is what we call conservation management of rare resources. And this is a kind of a conglomeration of a variety of work that we do in the division to support a variety of things, including our Minnesota Biological Survey, non-game program, and others. Right now, a lot of these programs are either funded with one-time funding or, as we talked about, the non-game program, declining funding. We're looking for an ability to provide some stable funding support for these conservation efforts. And we are proposing an increase from the Heritage Enhancement Account to do some of this work. Some of the key areas would be bat and pollinator conservation, maintaining and restoring some of the scientific and natural area operations, providing some base funding there, because right now it's coming from other sources, and then also stabilizing the non-game wildlife program implementation. So there's a variety of projects here. Some of it's maintained, and some of it's in new investments in work, especially around bat and pollinator conservation. Mr. Chair, the next proposal is Mississippi River Corridor Critical Area Rule Implementation. For those who know that the what we call the MRCA rules were adopted in January of this year after a long process, and the goal really is to improve protection of water quality and habitat and scenic views from Ramsey, Minnesota, all the way down to Hastings along the Mississippi River. These took a long time to get these rules in place, and now the next step is to implement them. And these are implemented at the local level. So local units of government have to update their plans and ordinances to become compliant with the new MRCA rules. and we're asking some one-time funding to assist in that effort. $450,000 to go towards grants to local units of government so they can implement and update those plans and rules, and $155,000 to the DNR to assist that so we can help develop those model plans and ordinances and work with them and provide technical guidance so we can get them all up so they're compliant. And so this will be a one-time fund to support and the implementation of the rules.
Representative Ubrum. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. My city has been heavily involved with this, the City of Champlin. Back when I was mayor, we worked the beginnings of this program. My question to you is, I mean, cities have their planning departments and obviously have been working with zoning laws and things all along the river, and I applaud you. This process has been good, and I think the DNR listened a great deal to the city's interests and things. But why do we need to provide grants to local governments to do their job in terms of zoning and planning? I think they're all aware of it. They all have staff and people that are entirely capable of doing this in their normal scope of business. So why do we need to spend this money on this?
Director. Mr. Chair, Representative. I think we heard from the communities, a lot of the local groups, that this would be a burden on them and be able to support their work, you know, that this would be an additional work for them to do this. So I appreciate your comments, where you're coming from, but we actually had one of the things against saying that it was going to cost them some significant amount of dollars for certain communities to implement it, and that would be a hardship. So we were looking at ways that we can reduce that pain for the cities and work with them to get them implemented in a timely fashion.
Representative Ubrum. I appreciate that, Director. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But you know, you're helping them out, but in the normal scope of their duties, they have the ability and resources to do this, or they should. So I applaud the effort here, but I think it's wasted money. Thank you.
There you go.
That's a drop mic.
Not recess. Representative Joaquin, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much of this quarter is above the drinking water intakes for Minneapolis and St. Paul?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiggins, I'm not sure exactly where the intakes are. This goes all the way up to Ramsey, the town of city of Ramsey, which is just south of Elk River.
Representative Wiggins.
I don't have a map in front of me. The intakes are around Fridley, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So part of this then would go north of those intakes.
That's right.
What, not... Minnesota doesn't have any source water protection plans for the drinking water for folks who drink the Mississippi River water. It's a million people. So my question is, how is this, what are you going to do about the drinking water source if you don't even know where it is? You don't even know where it is. How are you going to incorporate what you do into protecting the river as a drinking water source?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gaines, the MRCA rules are really about the uplands and the shorelands. It's not about, you know, treating the drinking water source. So that would be a separate issue that we work with. This is about setting setbacks and standards along the shoreline. I understand that they do provide water quality improvements, but not specifically for that, especially knowing that the water comes from a long way away as well, correct? From not just from this particular corridor.
Representative Morgan, yes.
If I could follow up, I mean, it's land use that makes the water hard to treat for drinking water. This, what you're doing, is land use. So, of course, it affects drinking water. It's runoff from land. And that is what affects drinking water. So it does seem to me that as you are developing whatever you're going to develop in the corridor north of the drinking water intakes, then you've got to be taking drinking water into account. And it just, I mean, that's fundamental to what we do. We're not just protecting lakes, rivers, and streams for swimming and fishing. We're protecting them for drinking water, too. And particularly if you use any legacy money, because legacy money has drinking water right up at the top. I'm sure Representative Green knows that.
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, duly noted. And we'll talk about that more. I just know what the confines and what's in here. And drink water is extremely important. And we understand not only for this corridor, but also what's contributed upstream from there as well, Representative Gist. So we will certainly consider that is part of the consideration all the way along.
Okay. Representative Guineas.
Well, I bring that up, Mr. Chair, because a million people do drink the Mississippi River water. And that's Minneapolis, St. Paul, a bunch of suburbs drink the water. And we have to treat it. We have to pay for the treatment. And our treatment's very expensive. Yet the state of Minnesota has no plan for source water protection. If you look at other states, they do all sorts of things to protect their drinking water. And we just seem to be focused on swimming and fishing, not drinking water. So that's why I bring it up. You'll hear me talk about that again.
I'm sure I will. Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify, so in concept, providing these grants to the local governments that are affected wouldn't really be any different than any of the other programs where we're providing grants to local governments, say in rural Minnesota, to help implement other rules.
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. I mean, we do provide grants to local municipal government for a variety of things to help, you know, improve whether it's on land use, variety of things. But this could be one of those. This is an example of one of those.
Okay, so
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Just to clarify, there's nothing unique about this idea or this concept. It just happens. This project, these rules, just happen to affect our more urban and suburban communities.
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this particular rules, again, was adopted for this critical area from Ramsey down to Hastings. So it is a specific area with specific rules. And so then we're trying to work with the communities within there to help them implement, accelerate, and get them done in a timely fashion.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Newbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Skinner, I appreciate you being here, being on the hot seat. I have a question here about the MRCCA rule. I'm not in the Sun County metro area. I'm just outside of that. But the Mississippi River does run through my district. And I have many times spoken with folks in my district who have river property, and they are not allowed to even cut down a single tree that's on the shoreline because it will alter the scenic view of the shoreline, and that is a federal regulation that they have to be in compliance with. So my question to you, Mr. Skinner, is as I look at this, it says the MRCCA rules will improve protections for water quality, habitat, and scenic views. My question is there an overlap here? Are we also dealing, first and foremost, the people along the river, are they dealing with this whole set of federal regulations and rules? And now once they jump through those hoops, the next step is to go through the MRCA rules as well. Is that correct?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are some federal regulations as well. These rules, there were some rules put, I would say, executive order and direction put back in place for this area starting back in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And so this was to codify that and get it up to a place where it's modernized it, make it more, make it easier for the communities to adopt. So all the communities were a part of this conversation over the years and have contributed to this. So things like setbacks or building heights, et cetera, were all in place, and then those were revised and then worked with the local municipal government to come to some agreement about what would fit best for these areas. They're even broken into zones for that particular. So, yes, there is still some federal worked, because this is a federal corridor as well as a state regulation as well.
Representative Berger.
Thank you for making that point, Mr. Skinner. So now we have the federal government that we have to deal with, and once they jump through those hoops for scenic view and other shoreline changes, then they have to go through the whole state set of hoops as well. I appreciate you documenting that for me.
Representative Hanson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Neuberger, that's just not true. I mean, it's not true that this whole thing was cooperative. And Representative Ugel knows this. This is an eight-year process, frankly, to harmonize these rules to make it easy in the cities. And we could have them come down and testify that the cities were supportive of this because it brought things into the 21st century. And before this, you had differences because you had differences in the science. So, you know, this was a rulemaking. I guess we need to start calling regulations protections, because that's what they are. They're protections. And this is actually protecting the cities. And now they're asking for money. And Representative Becker Finn was exactly right. You know, we had $10 million in the tax bill that didn't pass last year.
It did pass.
Didn't get signed. Didn't become law.
Thank you.
$10 million for helping local units of government comply with the buffer law. And if we take the population of the state that's along the MRCCA corridor, it's probably greater than the population that's getting that $10 million. So maybe, Mr. Chair, that $760,000 needs to be in the tax bill and should actually be bumped up, because there are differences in the critical area corridor. Mendota and Lilydale are not the same as Champlin or St. Paul or Minneapolis. They don't have a planning division to work on this. And you have all kinds, they don't even have staff, but they don't have the resources. So providing the assistance, if the assistance is okay for greater Minnesota, then it's okay for here. If we accept the idea that we need to give assistance for these protections, then we need to have them be applicable statewide. And we need to update the rules so that they're meaningful to protect both the cities, the economic development, providing the certainty, and providing the environmental protections that were intended. This is, I think, Mr. Skinner, the longest process in rulemaking probably in the history of the state, over 8 years, meeting after meeting after meeting. Everything we talk about and hear about involving the public was done. Everything was done. But a knee-jerk reaction that regulations are bad and relating anecdotes as to worst-case scenarios versus squeezing the controversy out of the process by having process that involves the public, that makes it valuable for not only 2017 but 2027, 2037, 2047, to adapt that information is where we need to go. This is a model of what we should do.
Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd like to just provide a little more background on that, if you grant me that privilege. The you know, the city of Champlin is a suburb, and we have the Coon Rapids Dam and the recreational pool behind it. So we have essentially many homes that back up to the river. They're typical suburban homes. They have beautiful landscaping and yards and everything else, and it's right down to the river. So we had, and the same in Coon Rapids, which I also represent, and the same in Anoka and Fridley and everything else. And initially, the rules that came out would have really placed a burden on the taxpayers and homeowners. They were, let's just say, they were a little far out for my constituents and things. But the DNR, through all of these meetings, and I went to a lot of them, through all of these meetings, listened to everybody. And I think they did a very good job in terms of setbacks, bluff line requirements, particularly down in your area there, and as far as replacement of existing structures and things like that. And by the time it was all done, our city planners in the entire Northwest area, and I'm talking Coon Rapids, Anoka, Champlin, Fridley, and all of those cities, were very pleased with the process, the way that it turned out. and it is going to provide additional protection for the river. It's never going to be the Boundary Waters canoe area, because it's not. It's suburbia. But it does, I think it's gone a long ways towards making things a lot better that way. So it was a good process. It was a long process. And I think basically everybody was pretty pleased with it. So that's a little background from my perspective. And as far as the money goes, fine. I think everybody's ready to get the job done. Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, I take a little bit different reflection on it than Representative Hansen does. I got a kick out of the phrase, we're helping local governments enforce it. And we're actually, we're mandating an enforcement. So, yeah, we should help them, give them some money, because it's something that we mandated on. And everybody thinks that because local governments are involved for boards, that it's okay with the public. There's two different things. There's local government and the public. One of my biggest problems down there is one of my county, and there are regulations down there about rivers and this and that. They're even worse than the DNR. So just because a board or the local government okays something, I know the local government is the truest form of government, yada, yada, but everybody can do harm. So it doesn't mean that the public or your Joe, the neighbors, can accept it just because your county did it. So.
And yada, yada. Members, I'm going to take a little executive privilege here. The Emerging Leaders Program is in at the Capitol today, and there was four couples up here from my district, from Marshall, Pennington, Roseau, and Kissing Counties. Jeremy and Tracy Fallon have stuck around. I just want to recognize them and all the members in the program, and the Griffins and the Rivards and the Hegedals from up in my area. So thank you very much for being here. And the topic of they have today at this time in their time slot is how government works.
It does.
Thank you. We got Cornish taken care of. Have I missed anybody? Okay, good. Let's speed this up. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to do my best here. The next proposal is actually a unique one. What this proposal is more of a change in our rules around hydropower use. We have about 8 facilities that long term that were in existence long before our rules were in place, and that currently are not in compliance with our hydroelectric hydropower facilities, and so. To bring them into compliance would be a burden on them financially, as there's a 7-year look back and a large amount of dollars. What we're actually asking to do in this particular legislation is to eliminate back fees for unpermitted water users, so we can bring them into compliance, and also put a cap on the amount of how much the fees would be to reduce the financial burden on these companies as we pull them into compliance. By bringing the compliance, would generate some additional dollars to the water management account, and that's where the appropriation would come from. But the real crux of this is trying to make sure that we don't put a new burden on these hydropower facilities as we bring them in. So, again, regulation to or new language to eliminate back fees or be able to waive back fees, and also set a cap for how much they would be charged long or, you know, annually from this.
Up here on Newberger. Okay, never mind.
Mr. Chairman, the next proposal is one that you saw last year in front of this committee, and that's the Pineland Sands Forest Conversion Study. As we know, up in the Pineland Sands, around between Wadena and Park Rapids areas, is large sandy areas that was right where Potlatch has had a lot of property, and they've been selling it off, and it's been being converted to irrigated agriculture. And there's some real concerns about what happens to the land and the water quality in that area. And so we are bringing back this proposal to try to study what the impacts of this conversion is on the land, so we can manage it sustainably long term. We're trying to leverage our work with other research that's going on in the area, also working with private resources to study and working with some of those landowners up there on this particular work. And so we really want to gain critical information about what those impacts are to the Pineland Sands, both on the landscape and also down into the aquifer, and then what can we do long-term to make sure that we can provide water sustainably throughout the Pineland Sands aquifer. And this would be a one-time appropriation. And, Mr. Chair, the last proposal from the governor's recommendations from our division is what Representative Green mentioned earlier is the Clean Water Fund. This is just the overview of the Clean Water Legacy from the Department of Natural Resources, and this would be a continuation of ongoing work that's come from that purpose. And there's really some key areas that we're working on to understand. We support statewide watershed assessments for flow monitoring. We do water level monitoring. We do a lot of the assessment work on biological surveys, analysis of fish contaminants, monitoring of groundwater and water supply management. So part of our job within our division is really to gather some information and provide it back towards all this work around clean water. All this work will support comprehensive watershed management planning, especially around one watershed, one plan work. And this will, I'm sure, will be another whole conversation in another committee as well.
Thank you. And to that point, another conversation. I know in the previous 2 years, RDO Farms has been very willing to be involved in the research along with Bemidji State. What are your plans for engaging them in your studies of the Pineland Sands area?
Mr. Chair, our hope is to continue all of that work, working with RDO and others on this study.
And to that point, what's the most recent conversation you've had with RDO Farms and Bemidji State?
Mr. Chair, we have not had much conversations in the past few months with them on this. So at the last, when we went through the last legislative session, and even after last, they were still very supportive of this. If it starts to go through, we'll re-engage with them.
So, Director Skinner, you're bringing a budget proposal forward, and you're asking for money, and RDO Farms is willing to be a partner, and you haven't engaged them in putting your budget together?
Mr. Chair, this is the same proposal as last year, which was supported. Their support was primarily to provide us opportunity to access their land to do some of the studies. That was the primary work, and so we will. And so we're bringing back the same proposal. But you're absolutely correct. I have not personally engaged with them in the last couple months.
Thank you, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You hit on some of my questions, but just to clarify, you make it sound like every speck of potlatch land is going to go into farmland. That's not the case. There were small parcels up there that were going to go in there. And the other thing that I notice here is, you know, we've just been talking about clean water, the problems we have with AIS, the Mississippi River Corridor, and instead of putting money or asking for money to go and fix these problems out of the clean water, now we're going to be looking at, basically, if you put the two together, we're looking at around $20 million for more studies. I mean, we study everything to death and nothing gets done. I've yet to sit in a committee where I've had any agency come to me and say, this is our conclusion. They only come and say, we need to do more studies. It gets pretty tiresome.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Two different questions. One, as you are in the Pineland Sands, are you going to be looking at pesticides as well as nitrates?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gaines, we'll be looking at multiple chemicals that are going down into the system. Nitrate is, though, one of the primary ones.
Well, all the...
Representative Wagenius.
Where there are nitrates, there will be pesticides, and where there are a lot of nitrates, there will be a lot of pesticides. So that's that's one thing. Secondly, now on to the Clean Water Fund. You are, and the outcomes, you are ensuring clean water for, and you put drinking in here, which is good. I'm glad to see that. However, do you have any measures? As far as I know, no state agency does any measures for drinking water in the Mississippi. So how would we know whether we're going to have a good outcome for drinking water without measuring it in the first place, having a baseline measurement?
Dr. Skinner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I would be happy to have our clean water specialist come and talk to you specifically about some of these work that we're going, they're doing, and we can certainly talk about what work is actually going on around the Mississippi River as well.
Okay, but
Representative Wagenius.
My specific question is, you want outcomes, you have to be able to measure them. You can only manage what you can measure. And we don't measure now the Mississippi as a drinking for drinking water purposes. And so if you're going to tell me you have these outcomes, we have to have a baseline measurement, and that's what I am interested in. And I think everybody would be interested in making that. You can't just say outcomes without being able to measure it and document it and say to us, well, this is actually what we got done, unless you have measures.
Thank you, Director Skinner. Okay. Members, change your schedules for this evening. We may be coming back. Mr. Bolt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Forrest Bolt. I'm the Director of Forestry. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I'd like to give you a brief overview of our main activities with the Division of Forestry and also the Governor's budget initiatives relating to forestry. The Division of Forestry manages 5 million acres of DNR-administered forest lands to provide clean water, wildlife habitat, places to hunt, fish, and recreate. One of our main activities is to manage the state's timber resources, and over the past 15 years, our goal has been to offer 800,000 cords of wood for sale annually, and of course now we've been asked to determine if a greater harvest level is sustainable. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. Our DNR lands provide 30% of the wood fiber used by the Minnesota forest products industry. The forest products industry provides 64,000 jobs and economic impact worth $17.8 billion. It remains the fifth largest manufacturing industry in our state. Timber harvesting is a very important management tool that we use and actually mimics natural disturbances of the past with, for instance, wildfires. It helps us to effectively and efficiently manage our forests, keeping them healthy and productive. We harvest about 40,000 acres in the state annually, and we're required by statute to reforest those acres. Roughly 10,000 acres need to be replanted or seeded, and the remainder is allowed to grow back through natural regeneration. We determine our reforestation methods based on what species is best for the site. So if it's pine, then we need to plant seedlings. If it's spruce, we need to do aerial seeding. For aspen, it's one of those species that grows back naturally. As a matter of fact, it grows back very prolifically after it's harvested. We also need to protect young trees like pine and oak from deer and other animals. We keep our forests healthy and productive. It certainly takes some work. And we do silvicultural treatments, and these treatments aren't like a medicinal treatment. It's a mechanical treatment. So we do things like tree thinning and removing unwanted trees so that these seedlings are free to grow. We were able to restart our inventory efforts 4 years ago after they've been suspended since about 2007 due to some budget cuts. And of course, all management activity really starts with a solid and timely inventory and good data. It's really the basis for all of our management decisions. So we need an accurate on-the-ground picture, and it makes us much more efficient, allows for sustainable forest management decisions. We also manage a large road system, and the road system contains 2,340 miles, provides access for recreation, for the general public use, provides fire protection, access, forest management, and timber production. We also know that over 90% of this state forest road use is recreational use. We have dozens of bridges and thousands of culverts in that particular system.
Now, members, just real quickly, the device that the forester is looking through there, quickly name it. What's it called? Nobody can get it. Okay, it's a clinometer. Let's go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We also assist private landowners. Last year, the legislature provided funding for a PFM initiative, $2.5 million this particular year, and $2 million ongoing. In the height of our assistance to private landowners, we had 43 FTEs that worked in the division that provided outreach to encourage landowners to actively manage their forest lands. In 2015, we were down to 5 FTEs, and so it was very important that we had this initiative, and thankful that we got it passed last year. We've been able to increase our PFM staffing efforts. We created a cost share program that supports private landowners in helping them with tree planting and timber stand improvement, helping them with erosion control and even invasive species removal. So a great program to have back in place again. We also are creating a buzz around forest management and helping and engaging private landowners to actively manage their land. We do this through workshops, field day demonstrations, and meeting with individual landowners. And, of course, our other big program is wildfire. We protect 45 million acres across all ownerships. We do prevention, which is public information, education, permitting. We have a township fire warden system. We do community and landowner assistance. And then there's the pre-suppression, which is getting all your contracts in place and the training, the planning, and then, of course, the actual suppression, which is putting out fires. Last year, we had 864 fires in Minnesota, burned 9,300 acres, way below our average. Our average is about 35,000 acres and 1,200 fires annually across the state. Many challenges facing forestry in these days. For the Division of Forestry, there's three that kind of rise to the top. One is the increasing demand for timber. Another is lack of stable funding for our reforestation efforts. And then finally, we're dealing with an antiquated computer system that really doesn't meet our needs for on-the-ground foresters or our planning needs. This was a computer system that was developed 25 years ago, and it's had a lot of patches over the years, but no major improvements. And so imagine running a business where you're selling a product and getting income that goes back to the state coffers with software that was developed 25 years ago. It's very challenging. You've seen this slide before. I'll not go over it in too much detail. I think what I wanted to point out here is that all of the forestry proposals, and we have three, are all in the invest category, and there's a total of 5 FTEs in that. Our first budget initiative is around reforestation. It is a $2.5 million request per year, so $5 million for the biennium. Per year, 1.25 requests coming out of the general fund and 1.25 coming out of the FMIA, or Forest Management Investment Account. That fund is generated by the sale of timber, so timber sale revenue. This includes 3 FTEs. And as I had suggested before, planting and growing trees after harvest is really the foundation for healthy forests. DNR has no base funding for reforestation. We've relied on bonding dollars in the past. Bonding dollars have not been as reliable as we'd like them to be, and really looking for a stable funding source. And by law, we must reforest after harvest, and that lack of stable dollars really limits our ability to do that. And without reforestation funding, our forests are really at risk for invasive species outbreaks, reduced wildlife habitat, diminished water quality, fewer recreation opportunities. If we don't have the reforestation dollars, we will need to reduce our harvest levels in Minnesota, and this would have a profound impact on the forest industry. And diverse forests certainly depend on reforestation, too. So without planting and seedling, the forest will convert to less desirable tree species or invasives or brush. In 2014, the Office of the Legislative Auditor report recommended that DNR seek additional resources to address functional and content shortcomings of our data system. And our current systems are out of date and inefficient. Phase one was funded by the 2015 legislature. This is phase two. The governor is recommending $4 million for general fund
out of the 1819 biennium to replace our data system that's old and antiquated. It's inadequate. It is a mix of one-time and ongoing funding. So, again, the request is $4 million for the 1819 biennium, $2 million for the biennium after that. And after that, those systems will be done and will be in a maintenance mode, so $1 million after that. We do have a couple of FTEs over the next two bienniums. We'll be purchasing minute FTEs during that development and implementation phase, but there is one FTE ongoing for this proposal. Our customers really expect us to operate at the speed of business, and this will certainly increase our efficiency and create accurate data to support our management decisions and allow us to get our work completed more quickly. As I suggested, this is phase one. The legislature provided $300,000 per year in the 16-17 biennium to keep our existing systems working and also undertake that business needs analysis. And we've done the needs analysis, and as I mentioned, this is phase two. The governor is recommending $500,000 for a sustainable timber harvest analysis in fiscal year 18. This is a one-time allocation, and there are no FTEs attached to this. The study will examine if an increased timber harvest of 1 million cords is sustainable on DNR lands, and if not, what that sustainable harvest level should be on DNR lands. We are in the process of hiring an independent contractor to complete the analysis. We've engaged partners in forest industry to participate in a stakeholder advisory group that provides us advice throughout the process. And upon completion, we and our stakeholders will have confidence in a sustainable timber harvest level that we can carry on for years. Really looking to provide the maximum wood supply to the industry while maintaining those critical resources that provide clean water, wildlife habitat, and recreation. Finally, as part of the governor's tax proposal, the Department of Revenue is proposing to update the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, and this proposal has an impact on our budget. The Sustainable Forest Incentive Act is a state program that provides private landowners an incentive to keep their forests as forests. Under this proposal, some of the duties have been realigned. So the Department of Revenue will administer all the financial aspects. DNR will administer all the land stewardship aspects, including registering the plans, determining the eligible acres, and annually certifying those, and then monitoring the compliance of these of this program. There are the DNR costs, $156,000 in FY18, $312,000 in 19, and $300,000 out into the future to do our part of this program. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Really? I like forestry. Members, we're going to end here for today, and I was just talked about coming back tonight, but staff told me I would be here by myself, so they're not coming back. Representative Hansen, we've talked. We think we can get through the rest of DNR's presentation tomorrow, and then Bowser will be on deck. And that's it. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.